going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, February 1st. Soon, I'll be joined by Managing Editor Ed Harrison. But first, with the day's stories, Haley Drasnan.
Hey, Jack. It's the first session of February, and all three major indices were up on Monday. Investors appeared to shake off concerns about all of that speculative retail trading that largely drove the market's worst weekly sell-off since October last week. Robinhood limited their restricted stock list to 8 from 50, and you can only buy 1 share of GameStop and 10 shares of AMC, for example. GameStop shares actually fell today, and trading was halted again at one point. But Robinhood announced it raised an additional $2.4 billion, and that's after $1 billion raised last week, so a combined $3.4 billion, making it the biggest fundraise since the app was first founded in 2013. So, this Reddit mania is still spreading. What's the next move forward? It's notable that precious metals are rising. Silver futures surged as much as 13% on Monday, and that's the highest since 2013. The Wall Street Bets Forum had multiple threads dedicated to a silver squeeze and prompted this buying binge. iShares Silver Trust ETF, which is the world's largest silver-backed ETF, has received more than $1 billion of inflows since Friday. Silver, of course, is a much bigger market than GameStop shares, and some of the Wall Street Bets' most loathed opponents, such as Citadel Advisors, really stand to profit from the iShares Silver Trust. So it will be harder to squeeze this market, but the fact that such a large and liquid market as silver can be targeted by retail investors says so much about this shift we're really witnessing. Retail investors are also now looking at investing in SPACs. They're even putting money into SPACs before they've revealed what company they're buying. Call it FOMO because they see these big gains in SPACs over the last year, and they think long-term investments rather than these fast trades might really help diversify their retail portfolios. Other things we're on the lookout for this week, Republican senators meeting with President Biden to consider their $600 billion stimulus proposal, which is much smaller than the Democrats' $1.9 trillion plan. And big tech earnings this week, Alphabet, Apple, Amazon, Alibaba, Snap. So another busy week ahead. Back to you, Jack.
I feel good.
Dad, are you singing to your cereal?
Yes, I am, like I knew that I would.
No, a dance too?
Come on, Ava. Silk almond milk. Starts the morning on a high note.
Yow!
Songs, dances, and dad jokes. Oh,
so good! So good! I got you!
Silk almond milk.
With calcium, vitamins A, D, and E.
Feel plenty good.
Thanks, Haley. Welcome, Ed.
Yeah, good to talk to you, and happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, too. So, Ed, there's so much to go over. There's GameStop, there's silver. Commodities are going up across the board. What's on your mind? What do you think we should start with?
Yeah, I think maybe we can give a broad market sweep and talk about how the sentiment feels. It does feel like there's a certain degree of normalcy that's returned to the market in a lot of places. I always look at the bonds first and foremost. So I was looking at the 10-year. The 10-year is trading at 106.9. That's down 2.5 basis points from a 1.9 level. It seemed like it wanted to go higher, you know, that it was moving back towards those levels where it had resistance at 119 and backed off. At some point, maybe it looked like it was going to retrace, but this seems like it's still range bound. It's in this new range that it's broken out to above 1%. So it's somewhere in that 1% to 119 level. And if it stays in that level, then, you know, that's largely a range bound market. Then if you look at the indices, you know, they were back to being up. All three indices were up, with the NASDAQ up 2.5%. And then you mentioned that commodities were also up. And, the big breakout there was natural gas in addition to copper, or in addition to silver, rather. You know, silver, you know, it tested the 30 level. That's something that we're going to talk about later. And people were talking about retail investors getting involved in that. But really, when you look at the end of the day, you know, natural gas was up more than silver. And silver is such a big market. You really do wonder how much of a play that retail investors can have there. But overall, what I would say, if I looked at all the markets, it's definitely reminiscent of the reflation trade. That is that commodities prices are up, stock prices are up, yields are actually down, which gives a little bit more oomph to equities, and it all is positive.
Right. Just to give a little context of what you said, so silver was up about 8% today. That's the most it's been up for a daily rate of change in well over a year. That would be something to remark upon, would be remarkable, I should say. But compared to the extreme price action that we've seen in GameStop, it seems almost vanilla. Is these Wall Street Bets traders, is it possible they're having a little bit more difficulty moving one of the most popular metals in the world than they are a distressed retail name like GameStop with a low float and extremely high short interest? This narrative is at least that they've moved on from GameStop to silver. What do you make of that?
Yeah, there were a number of reports to that effect earlier in the morning, and I tweeted out some of those reports. I didn't mention Reddit or Wall Street Bets in any of the tweets that I did, but I talked, about how it looked like retail investors might be getting into these trades, and that some analyst from Commerzbank was saying, these guys, we're going to run them over, or they're going to get run over, et cetera, which I thought was kind of interesting. But the long and short is, first of all, we don't even know. I think it's a tenuous to non-existent connection to the things that were going on with GameStop. There were some comments in that Wall Street Bets Reddit forum that were deleted, but by no means was that forum dominated by the move on to silver. Okay, so the concept that they're now leaving GameStop and the trades that are associated with that whole nexus of large shorted bets, it's unproven. And moreover, going to your question, it's not going to work with silver. It's a much larger market. I'd be skeptical. I mean, anything's possible, right? And given what happened at GameStop, you might think, okay, but to the degree that it's a large market and they, try to go in size, you're right, 8%, that's pretty good. That's the best in over a year, but it's not, 300%. It's not 500%. So they're not going to be able to move it the way that they did something like GameStop.
Right. Ed, I just want to go back to GameStop and get a little bit into the mechanics of it. You saw outlets like Bloomberg and CNBC reporting that the short interest is down. The hedge funds who were extremely exposed to rises in the GameStop share, they've covered their shorts. And just on Wall Street Bets today, I saw that the reaction to this news was extremely negative. They posted lies. There's no way the short interest is still there. I actually got some pretty good data from S3, which gives real-time data on the short interest as a percentage of the float, which is actually one of the hardest things to get your hands on, because I think FINRA reports the data twice a month, but to get real-time data is quite hard. So, but the short interest of GameStop, it was at about 130%, which was last week, which was what it was reported to be. Now it's at 53.15%. So still very high. Still very high, but well down from its peak of being in the 130s and 140s, where there it was literally dry kindling that was ready to be lit on fire. Now it's more like some wet leaves, where it has some potential to explode. But National Beverage Corp. Fizz, which is LaCroix, if you drink seltzer water, they have a higher short interest now than GameStop. So the shorts have covered a little bit. They're still a little exposed. So what do you make of that, Ed?
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, given the pain And also given the statements that were made by the hedge funds that received the most pain, it would suggest that they've gotten out of the positions. Not only did they feel the pain because those were extreme moves, they have every incentive to get out. You know, imagine that you're a hedge fund that lost, you know, billions of dollars even on this trade. Would you really go back in and reestablish a position and then potentially lose money again? I think you would probably close out your position. So there are a lot of people who have probably closed out their positions for sure.
Right. And by closing out their positions, they lost money. And we saw that Melvin Capital was down 53% only 1 month into the year of 2021. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I really do wonder where the risk controls were there. You know, I asked that question. Actually, I got almost 1,000 likes on when I asked the question, where the heck were the risk controls? And there were one or two people, Alex Gurevich, and I think John Hempton in particular, who replied that I thought in a positive way, saying that, look, you know, if you're in the trenches, it's a little bit more difficult. It's not, you know, the whole concept that it's pretty easy to figure these things out and not lose 50%. It's not really quite that simple. You know, these were massive moves. I'm not really, you know, I understand where they're coming from, but the reality is that these guys were naked. They were swimming naked on the short side, or they completely, blew away their risk stops, and they got their asses handed to them, because at the end of the day, risk is about dealing with unforeseen circumstances. It's not that you're dealing with tail risk and you're going in naked saying that this tail risk is not going to materialize. It's more that right from the get-go, you're giving up a little bit of the upside in order to make sure that you're covered if the move goes in the opposite direction.
Right. And I get what the points that Alex Gurevich and John Hempton were saying. If you have a block of 30,000 shares or you're short 30,000 shares, you can't just go on E-Trade and buy 30,000 shares. You have to put in a price that's above the current market price and try and find a seller of those shares. And especially if there are no shares available, you could be charged extreme prices. So this is by no means official, and I'm not saying that anything transacted anywhere close to that, but there were asks for the stock I saw on Bloomberg of $10,000 for GameStop stock. And right. I think the official top tick was 470 or something around there, but there were stocks that were sold at $550.
Right.
So it's always, I remember one time I was in a bar with Mike Green and Josh Wolf, which, by the way, an interview with them came out today, interesting enough. But and Mike said to me, he said, prices don't exist. Basically, what you see when you look up Google and you see it goes like this, that is a compendium of a series of transactions that if you're a big player in the market will not be available to you. That's why when you want to build a position, if you're an institutional player, you have to, stack up these trades rather than buying in one fell swoop. And I want to turn to the derivatives picture. I've been reporting a little bit on the gamma squeeze in GME, and I actually have some new data for the folks watching this. How about we go to this new bubble chart from today that I got, and then we can go into your charts, sort of analyzing what delta and gamma really are and what they really mean. So
okay, this that is sounds a chart. Great.
This is a chart from today. Again, on the y-axis, it's the moneyness of the option. So the strike price, what percentage of that is of the underlying price right now. And on the y-axis is the open interest. And the size of the bubble is the volume of the trade. So you'll note that it looks pretty similar to the one on Friday. Out of the money options, deep in the money options dominate in terms of open interest, with one exception. And that is this huge outlier on the right, all the way to the top. And that is a call with a strike price of 800, so about 330% of the money. By the way, all these options expire for GameStop on February 5th. So Ed, that made, and we were talking a little bit before this, that made me think that the cards for a gamma squeeze, it could be in the cards because people are buying these out of money the options. But you had a slightly different interpretation. So why don't you tell me what you're thinking about that?
Yeah, so I'll tell you what I'm thinking about in terms of the gamma squeeze. Also in terms of, you know, the fact that these shorts have lowered their positions, and then how that chart corresponds to last week and then this week. So what I'm thinking is that when you think of a when you look at a gamma versus strike price, okay? So I have a chart, this first chart that I'm going to show you. It shows call options and put options, and it shows you what the gamma is for various prices, and then it shows what the strike price is or the at-the-money strike is. And what you'll notice in both calls and puts is the gamma rises very significantly toward the highest level around the strike price. So at the money, options have the highest gamma levels. That's the first thing to realize as well. Okay, so that's number one. Then I have a second chart, which has four different curves to it. You know, it shows 14-day, 42-day, 77-day, and 197-day options. And what that's showing you basically is, you know, very short dated options to longer dated options. And what you'll notice is that a much larger percentage of the gamma is at the strike price. So for the short dated options. So what that means is that, you know, the rise in gamma for short dated options is enormous as you go towards the money. So, that previous slide that we showed before, this is, you know, four variations of that given the length of your option contract, the expiry date. So there are two things that you can draw from this is that, if you want to get the most gamma, which means that you want to, there's the delta is moving the most. You want to have options that are at the money, and you actually want them to have a very, the strike price has to be, the expiry has to be fairly short. So short dated options at the money have the highest gamma. That's basically what I'm trying to say. And so you have two strategies here. One is that you want to have high gamma so that you can get these delta hedging from the market makers to move the stock up. And so as what happens is if you have enough things that are around the strike price and slightly above that you put on, and you put it on in size, you can create enough delta hedging to move things into the zone where gamma explodes and there's more delta hedging, and probably there's going to be some shorts that cover, and then therefore there's more delta hedging, et cetera. So there's a whole nexus of trades that are happening that are at or near the money, but those are expensive. You know, the closer you are to at the money, the more expensive those options are. So you're going to want to, in order to get the biggest bang for your buck, in order to make the most money out of this trade, you're going to want to have deep out of the money options. And so that's what that bubble, that 800 bubble that you showed me, it does. So it's sort of a barbell strategy. On the one hand, you want to make sure that you're hurting the shorts by getting the highest gamma so that you can move the delta hedging up as much as possible. But then you also want to make sure that you have as much leverage as possible. So buying deep out of the money calls. And when those calls go up, you know, when the price goes up, those calls will be closer to in the money and they will escalate, you know, massively in price. So what you saw in your bubble chart is a combination of last week and this week, because The 330 number, I think, is last week's deep out of the money 1 week calls. That's, they didn't have the 800 contract because, you know, it wasn't at 800. It was like at, you know, 50 or 30 or whatever it was. And so when the move spiked up, you know, massively, all of those contracts went into the money. Or now they're actually, some of them are out of the money because GameStop sold off today. But they also put out an 800 contract. So there are tons and tons and tons of people in the retail community right now who are trying to play the exact same game they played last week with the 800 calls that they played with the, I think it's the 300 or the 330 calls. And my supposition is they're not going to make money. That, you know, the gamma squeeze is over for the reasons that you showed us at the beginning. When you showed us that short interest had been taken out of the market, you know, this isn't 136% short interest. This is like 45% short interest. And, you know, you're not going to get as much short cover and you're not going to get that massive gamma squeeze. And so 800 is never going to happen. And so all of those options, which are all short dated options, they're going to expire worthless.
Yeah. Ed, thank you for explaining that. I think that was really helpful. I like to think of it as buying in the money options or near the money options that, as you said, are extremely short dated weekly options that have the most gamma. That's kind of like lighting a match and to get this thing going. Buying the super out of the money options, they actually have a low gamma. But it's kind of like pouring kerosene on the fire. The problem is, if you only pour kerosene on a pile of wet leaves, you're gonna get nothing. I'm just looking now that the short interest is much lower. These sort of uncut gems bets of thinking that this is going to go nuclear. This is let's buy an option at 800. Let's drive it to 1,000. That hopefulness is still there. But it seems less likely. I will say, and I was talking to Weston before this, that the delta for that 800 call option that expires this Friday is 11 or 0.11, indicating, he said, that it has an 11% chance of expiring in the money. So I think that that's at least what the market is assigning. So I think what Weston is, you know, prediction when he said it to me and Nick on the exchange that GME closes above 1,000 or below 10, I would probably make that a little less polarized. I would say I'd say it likely closes this week below 100, but if it doesn't close below 100, it could go above 1,000, and that's a very, very small percentage chance, but still existent. Of course, with the caveat that I don't know what's going to happen. Just like no one knows what's going to happen. But you know, it's fun talking about the market structure with you, Ed. Just the last thing on the options.
By the way, those options with that 11 delta, that's definitely based on volatility levels that were skewed, you know, higher because of what happened last week. All of those options are the price for those options and the implied volatility are much higher than they would be if we didn't already have the gamma squeeze from before. So again, you know, it's yet more proof that these people are piling into a trade that played out perfectly last week. But now that it's already played out, I think that the chances of it's happening again are much lower, especially lower than is implied by the price of the option and the implied volatility.
Right. Ed, I think you're dead right about that. And I'm actually really glad that you brought that up because that ties really well with this last chart I want to show, where the white line on the left axis is GameStop, GME, and the red line on the right axis is a 20 put option, a put option of strike price of 20 that expires this Friday. And if you can believe it, on Wednesday, the put option was priced at about a little below 40 cents. But as the stock increased, again, a massive departure from the put option. Again, if you want a put option, you want the stock to go down. As the stock increased to above $400, the price of that put option actually increased, meaning that the market was pricing in that at $400, it's more likely to be below 20 by Friday than it is at $100 last Wednesday. So That just goes to show that the underlying stock price, the current price, is only one factor in the pricing of an option. The other factor being, as you said, implied volatility.
Introducing Batiste Sweat-Activated and Touch-Activated Dry Shampoo. With breakthrough technology that absorbs oil and releases bursts of fragrance whenever you sweat or touch your hair for up to 24 hours, it's the ultimate hair care for girls on the go. Try the newest dry shampoo that's activated by you. Batiste, the future of hair care is here. Buy Batiste Dry Shampoo online or in store at your nearest retailer.
You know, interestingly, I would say about the implied volatility and my supposition with regard to those short-dated calls that are deep out of the money, expiring worthless. What about the puts on the other side? Implied volatility has gone up. It's made the puts more expensive just because of the volatility, not because, they're more in the money. Maybe that's the call to make, actually, is to buy the puts this time instead of the calls.
Yeah, that is definitely a play as well. And then there are the people who are saying the volatility is so overpriced, I'm going to sell you a put. And it's funny, Ed, if you had bought a put option for February 5th, put option of $20 last Wednesday for 40 cents, so $40 your option premium, I'm sort of repeating myself here, but you would have made money as the stock skyrocketed higher.
It's fascinating stuff. Yeah, you can look at these things all day. I mean, for me, the bottom line, though, is that the market seems to have digested it this week. It's behaving more normally across a wide swath of different asset classes. And, the people who are still in this trade, I think that, the air is being sucked out of it, and GME is more likely to fall than it is to rise. What I would also say is that this whole silver squeeze thing, that's another trade that I'm not a fan of. I don't think that it's going to happen. I think that, the 8% pop that we got, that was great. It was a nice little follow on from GME. Hey, if you had some options on that, kudos to you. But that squeeze, I don't see it lasting. We'll have to see tomorrow what happens.
Absolutely. Ed, moving on to a slightly different topic, I read your blog yesterday that spoke more about the spirit of this move, namely that the names that are really receiving attention are not the technological high flyers like they were in the 90s, but old names, companies like GameStop, companies like Blockbuster, even though Blockbuster is a bankrupt entity. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I mean, how would we frame it? Like, if we wanted to put a frame around it, I think it's interesting that the frame you could put around it is that there are larger fat tail distribution outcomes for those particular names, and so that they're more interesting from an optionality perspective. Which is why people are in these names, both on the short side and also in terms of these options. Because think about what happens in the future for these companies. On the one hand, it's either companies that are passe, GameStop is kind of passe, Tootsie Roll is, or have been affected incredibly by the pandemic, like American Airlines, as an example. And so, when we get to the other side of the vaccine and we get to a new normal, we don't know what that new normal is going to be. It could be that new normal is one in which GameStop, no one ever goes to a GameStop practically. Now they just download. The pandemic has changed their behavior permanently. Same thing for AAL. Maybe American Airlines, no one wants to get on a long haul flight to Cancun or to Cabo San Lucas, because why would they do that when they can go somewhere that's closer by and avoid getting into a plane, which increases their risk factor a little bit more. So there are outcomes where it's very positive for companies like American Airlines, but there are outcomes where it's incredibly negative. And that, those fat tail outcomes are what people are looking at. And I think that's why these are the companies that people are thinking about the most. There are very extreme outcomes. It's like, bankruptcy and liquidation, or they've been beaten down so much that they explode to the upside.
Mm-hmm. And Ed, what can you tell me about why you think these beaten down companies are exploding to the upside. We went through a phase in 2020 where it was the companies showing tremendous revenue growth, you know, over 100% per year. It was the technological companies that were the companies of the future. Now the companies that are being short squeezed and being are skyrocketing are not the companies of the future. They feel like the companies of the 1980s or 1990s. Do you think it's, can you attribute any sort of psychological motivation to that, or am I reaching here?
No, I think you're spot on, because basically if you believe in the reflation narrative, the answer would be that those are the companies, especially to the degree that the new normal is, you know, mostly like the old normal, which is why you believe in reflation. Those companies are going to do well. What you're saying is that, you know, we've beaten down stuff so much because of the pandemic. And now that we have the vaccine and reflation is coming, and we're going to have an incredible, you know, pop. These stocks are the ones that you want to be in, because they're going to benefit the most. They're the ones that people sold off the most. They were giving up for dead. Even if it's business as usual for them, they were trading as if they were about to go bankrupt, and they're not. So let's buy in. So I think that there is that psychology there. But that's very tied to the reflation trade. Once the reflation trade is over, if it becomes over, meaning that we get further into this tunnel of the vaccine, and we find that people get less ebullient about markets and about the backside of the coronavirus pandemic, then I think people will start to reevaluate, and there'll probably be less bullishness for these names. And the short sellers at that particular juncture, they will reassert themselves, and they will come back into the fold.
Mm. Ed, just you mentioned short sellers at the end there. This has been a wake-up moment for the long short hedge fund, that bottle of that market neutral hedge fund. We're going to make money no matter what, because we're going to go long X and we're going to go short Y. And because we're so smart, X is going to go up and Y is going to go down. And even if they both go up, X is going to outperform Y, so everything is going to be okay. Well, we saw what happened with Melvin Capital. Everything was not okay. So that's why we've seen these record degrossing of books for these long short hedge funds. What do you think about pure activist short sellers? You know, people like Mark Cohodes, who, by the way, did an interview that comes out Thursday, or Carson Block, who's a regular on Real Vision. People who are hunting out fraud and saying, I feel so confident in that this is a fraud, I'm going to put my money behind this. Do you think there's a distinction there between activist short sellers and the long short hedge fund book?
Well, it depends. I mean, it goes back to your question about, you know, the sizing, the risk controls. I mean, to me, the risk controls are a sizing and a hedging question. And if you listen to the Carson Block, Jim Chanos interview that we ran, Jim Chanos was talking about how he thinks about it. And to me, there's a lot of prudence in what he's talking about. You know, you want to size correctly, and you also want to hedge. And if you don't do both of those things, you know, tail risk can bite you in a big way. There's no way that you can claim to lose 53% in a single month and say we were appropriately hedged ahead of time. We didn't have poor risk controls. Something is wrong if your fund is that leveraged to one specific trade, which apparently it was with Melvin Capital.
Right. And that's the problem with short sellers is that, you know, Ed, let's say you go long Apple and Apple declines. Apple is less of a problem in your portfolio, even though you were wrong. If you short Apple and it goes up, it becomes a bigger and bigger percentage of your portfolio because you have to keep on posting more and more collateral. So these things can spiral out of control. And if you don't have that prudence to manage risk, things can blow up like we saw this time. But Ed, I want to turn to question and pick your brain on another question, which is the question of Robinhood. We saw that they trimmed the number of stocks from 50 to 8 of the stocks that they limited trading on. Yet questions remain about what's really going on there. I saw in your blog, you posted it was really a clearance problem, really a liquidity issue. Could you give us some more detail on that?
Yeah, I think there were one or two different clearing houses that asked Robinhood and a bunch of other brokerages to post more collateral. And the new narrative is that they were pressured, like Citadel, for instance, pressured one of the two to make it happen. I don't believe that narrative is necessarily true. I would tend to discount it in general. I think that the volatility was so extreme that it makes sense that the clearinghouse would ask them to post more collateral. And then the question becomes, who's their customer? You know, these are commission-free trading platforms. Where are you making your money? And is it aligned with the incentives and the needs of the people who are using your product? So the way that I look at it is, if you're not paying for something, and the only reason that that product exists is to create a mass audience, like Gmail as an example, or like Facebook, then you are basically the product. There's something, your flows, in the case of Robinhood, you know, because they're selling flows over to you know, high frequency traders. That's the product. That's where they're making their money. That's where their incentives are aligned, because those are the people who are paying them. What you want is you want your incentives and your needs to be aligned with those of the company who's selling you the product, because they sold it to you and you're their customer. And that's not what we see with Robinhood. And I think that that's an intrinsic sort of problem. You know, that's a tension that they're going to have for a long time until they figure out how to solve that tension.
Right. I think there are three ways that these retail brokerages make money. Number one, they invest money that's just stored as cash in your account. Number two, they lend out stocks, securities lending, which is kind of related to all this, and they earn a little bit on that. But those two things are nowhere close to make enough money. I think the primary reason that these businesses are not just profitable businesses, but growth businesses, is selling data order flow. And might I add, I don't think it's not just Robinhood. It's E-Trade as well. It's all of these other retail brokerages. So Ed, I guess my question is, what can retail traders do to protect themselves? Do they buy and hold, not transact? You know, what are your thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, you know, Robinhood, they settled a case in December that was based on practices where, you know, they got a high bid from one of their customers to get the order flow, and you know, they put cost that on, they pass that on to their customers. You know, basically, their retail brokerage customers were paying more money than they would have had Robinhood had a different deal with the high frequency trading outlet. And so they did a deal where they didn't, they neither denied nor accepted that they did XYZ, you know, and then their representative said, actually, you know, that was a different time. We're constantly evolving our business. We're in a different place. When I read that, to me, what it said is that, you know, this is, you know, caveat emptor for the individual. To me, we're going through a mania. And just like there was a mania in the 90s that and things changed afterwards, they're going to change now. And it's not clear to me whether or not no cost, no commission brokerages will survive. Maybe one of the outcomes here will be actually that you will have to pay in order to make transactions, just at a minimum to align the incentives of the brokerage and the brokerage customers.
Right. Ed, my final question for you is, to what degree do you think that this, not just speculative mania, but the problems with the retail brokerages and the clearinghouses, in the fact that the volatility is way beyond their models and they're having to restrict customer activity because if they don't, they're going to have serious liquidity issues, which, by the way, you know, an adage that I've read is that if a CEO goes on CNBC and says that their company doesn't have liquidity issues, they tend to have liquidity issues. You know, a few banks from 2008 come to mind. So Robinhood, Vlad Tenev, he went on CNBC and said, we don't have liquidity issues. It's appearing that they do. What do you make of those issues? And to what degree, you know, Raoul put out a piece this Sunday saying that this poses systemic risk and that the daisy chain could unwind. What do you think of that?
What I think is that volatility is bad in that way, because what we've seen is the volatility that was so great metastasized in ways that were unforeseen. You know, not only did we get the gamma squeeze on this individual case, but the gamma squeeze led to, you know, a 53% loss for a hedge fund. Just imagine how systemic that hedge fund could be in a larger situation. And it also led to liquidity problems for the company, the brokerage that was hosting many of the people who were actually profiting, who were getting a positive outcome. What that tells you is that when volatility goes up, there are unforeseen consequences. And when you have a mania, as we do right now, that's likely to happen. And so those are sort of the black swans of the future.
Sorry, that leads me to one last question, which is more of a white swan than a black swan. But what are your current thoughts on the variants? I read your piece today. You seem quite concerned about them.
Oh, you mean the coronavirus variant?
Yes, yeah. Yes, I do, yes.
I would put it this way, that we're in a race against time with the variants, that we know the variants exist because we have had so many infections that they've been able to mutate. But it's not necessarily the case that the mutations can't be stamped out with this vaccine or, you know, some rejiggered version of the current vaccine crop that we have, where we get like a booster shot, say, in 2022. But the gray swan, I would call it, is the concept that coronavirus is here to stay. You know, there, I saw that John Barry, who wrote The Great Influenza, which I read, you know, probably 10 years ago, he wrote that he thinks that it may end up that this coronavirus thing becomes just like influenza, where every year we have shots. And to the degree that coronaviruses are infectious and deadlier than flu, either we learn to live with it and the mortality, or there's a future where certain businesses, certain activities are changed forever. And when we don't interact quite in the same way, we have a new normal that is reasonably different from the old normal, and there'll be an adjustment period to get there. And some, there'll be winners and there'll be losers as a result of that.
Right. Well, Ed, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much.
Yeah, great talking to you, Jack.
Yeah, and Ed, speak of new normal, are you going to have to do some shoveling for snow?
I'm getting my son to do the shoveling. Hopefully, he's doing it, you know, like bitching and moaning, but he's still out there.
No, he's doing it now. Nice. Well, I'm going to do that right after. I'm going to take this jacket off, put in something a little more informal.
Yeah, you guys have it worse than we do, so.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Ed. Talk soon.